I'm here today with Roger Bootle. He is the founder of Capital Economics and the author of many excellent books, including the just released The Trouble with Europe, which we're going to talk about, among other things, today. So, Roger, can we just start by talking about the premise of this book? What was it that prompted you to write it?
Well, I think I write books as a sort of public service, for a start. I certainly don't write them to make money. And also, I write them to try and get my ideas straight. I find I can't usually think very clearly unless I'm writing about things. And this idea has just been, the writing the book really grew out of the fact that I wasn't sure what I really felt about this European issue.
Okay, so just to stop you there, you didn't start writing this book as a Eurosceptic, because you are known to be pretty sceptical about the Eurozone, so, but you started it, you feel, with a pretty open mind.
I wouldn't quite say that. No, I've never really been accused of that. I've always been Eurosceptic in the sense of being sceptical about the euro as a currency. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things about the European Union that I, for ages, haven't liked. But I hadn't sat down and worked out fully what the costs and benefits would be of leaving the European Union. I hadn't really got stuck into the arguments. So in that sense, I was open-minded.
Okay. Right, so started with an open mind and ended with...
Oh, well, it's still open, but it's more decided in the sense that I find it extraordinary that all sorts of people on both sides of the debate are convinced that this is of major importance for the British economy, in the sense that if we stay in or go out, it's going to cost us squillions and squillions and squillions, and you know, wipe off or add 5-10% to our GDP. And yet there are so many studies of the issue that show actually the net balance of advantages and disadvantages is fairly small. I think it's in many of the less tangible things that the most important aspects of this issue are to be found, and with regard to how things develop in the future. That's to say, you know, if you think for political reasons, political and other reasons, it would be a good thing for Britain not to be in the EU, then I think one of the consequences of reading my book would be that you'd come away thinking, well, actually, there isn't an economic case to say that that should be overruled. We can do it.
Okay, so economically, being in or out is marginal over the medium to long term. Upheaval in the short term, obviously,
yes.
But marginal over the medium to long term.
No, I think probably in the long term, it's not marginal. I think it can then be significant, because I see Europe going largely the wrong way. Over-regulation, over-integration, and that I think the costs of that are going to grow over time. And similarly, Europe's fading in relative importance in the world. And I think if Britain were outside the European Union, it could take another direction. It could deregulate quite a lot, and I think bring quite a lot of advantages. So I think it's complex. There's short-term disruption, difficult. Medium-term, however long that is, I think the net balance is fairly marginal. Looking out longer term, I think it could be substantially positive, actually, to be out.
Okay, interesting. So the main economic negative, as you see it right now, to being in the Eurozone is that we've effectively hitched ourselves to the wrong part of the world, the wrong horse, geographically.
I think that's a substantial factor. But the really important thing, of course it's so difficult to pin down how much this costs us, is the wave of regulation coming from Brussels. Now, one of the reasons why it's so difficult actually to assess is we don't know, of course, what we would do in the absence of these regulations. We might impose the same regulations ourselves.
And we're quite keen on regulation.
We are, absolutely.
Great tendency to put it in place.
We're absolutely right. And of course, it depends partly on who's in power. But you can imagine a scenario in which we could come out of the European Union partly thinking we're going to benefit from not having all these regulations. And then let's say we've got a Labour government and it's now got the power to rescind these European regulations, but actually looks at it and says, well, funnily enough, actually, we quite like all these, we're not going to change them. In which case, one of the big positives simply doesn't happen.
And would it not be the case that in order to keep trading with Europe anyway, we'd have to put a lot of the same regulations in place to maintain free trade agreements?
This is a tricky issue. I think one of the most important points in the case against staying in is that, yes, we have to have certain regulations in place if we're trading with Europe. But if we weren't in the EU, we'd only have to have those in place in those industries and businesses which we're actually exporting to the EU. And of course, that's a tiny minority in relation to the system as a whole. If you're actually in the EU, then you have to impose those regulations across the whole economy. Mm. So little sandwich sellers in Dagenham have to comply with the regulations about, you know, working hours, all these other things. Whereas if we weren't in the EU, that wouldn't apply.
Okay, let's look at the economic stagnation of Europe, the idea that we're hitched to the wrong horse. Is there any way that can end while the Eurozone stands?
I think the Eurozone is a complete disaster. And I'm not a Johnny Come Lately on this subject. I was saying it right from the beginning. And the problem is really, it's twofold. Firstly, you've got these countries on the southern periphery, Greece, of course, the most intense example, but also Italy, Spain and Portugal, which are uncompetitive. In the past, they would have depreciated their exchange rates, and that would have kept them in the game, essentially. They can't do that. So they're mired in a dreadful situation, low GDP, huge unemployment. Greece has lost 25% of its GDP during the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, horrendous, really horrendous. That's problem number one. But the second aspect is it's not fully appreciated, and it is, I think, at least as important. And that is the tendency for Germany and the Netherlands and some other countries, but mainly those two, to do too much saving. They run their policies too tightly. The German companies sell sort of wonderful stuff across Europe and across the world, and then the income received from that is not fully spent. Now, in the days of, this is vital to the euro, it's right at the centre of the euro question. In the days before the euro, when the Deutschmark was in existence, the Germans were just as German then. They were wonderful engineering and exporting and making things. They worked jolly hard, all that stuff. And they had a natural tendency to run up surpluses, to save too much then. But the currency stopped that tendency from being fully realised. They would do all this non-spending and working, and up would go the Deutschmark. And that would attenuate these tendencies to be able to export a lot. And so it's the combination of those two things. So what the euro has done is it's locked together these two groups of countries that behave fundamentally differently. And in the old days, the exchange rate acted as a flex, a hinge, enabling those two sorts of countries to work together. Without it, well, you've got this ghastly stagnation.
So without the common currency, if we just had a European Union without a common currency, could that have lasted? Could that have worked better?
Oh, I think it would have worked much better. I mean, most of what's wrong in the European Union at the moment is, I think, the euro. But if you look at the historical record, it's quite clear that Europe was not doing that well before the euro came into existence. I mean, the gaps aren't huge, but they're there. Go back far enough, and of course, right from the beginning, the European Union was very successful, which is the real reason why Britain joined. Those countries from the late 50s into the 60s, early 70s were growing very fast. And we thought this was a miracle economic era, and we better hitch ourselves to that wagon. And then more or less, as soon as we joined, funny enough, the relative growth performance started to deteriorate. Because, of course, the 70s were grim for Britain. Come the 80s, we started to improve. The continent started to do a bit worse. And then we got the emerging markets growing very strongly. And throughout the last 20 or 30 years, the performance of the Eurozone compared to other countries around the world has been deteriorating. Mm.
And in terms of the of countries possibly leaving the Euro, like, you're not particularly concerned about Greece, are you? But you're rather concerned about some of the other peripheral nations.
Well, I think for Greece to leave is a huge step, of course. I think it would be a good thing for Greece. If I were advising the Greek government, I would advise them to do precisely that.
Because you have to wonder who is advising them not to.
Well, I think this is actually largely political, really. I mean, very often, you know, people say to me, why is it that the Greek government or the Greek people don't want to leave the euro? And I say to them, I think this is a bit like the economic equivalent of Stockholm syndrome. In the world of psychology, apparently there's this phenomenon where someone's held captive in a cave, as it were, or a cage. They strike up a relationship with their captor, and then after so many months of all this, when the door is open, they don't want to leave. Well, I think this is a bit like that. If you go back in history, you hardly ever find a case where a country locked in an unfavourable exchange rate regime wants to leave. Britain, 1992, forced out of the ERM. What happens? I mean, the news readers that night, September the 16th, 1990, they're practically wearing black armbands. You know, oh, business surveys, business optimism collapsed, consumers are depressed, people are putting keys through the letterboxes, you know, it was all falling apart. In fact, of course, we now know that was the beginning of our escape from recession. 1931, Britain came off the gold standard. Were there people clamouring to come up? No, not on the contrary. They were stuck there desperately trying to stay in. Mm-hmm. And only after they'd been forced out did they realise this was their salvation. So I think Greece is similar.
Okay, and Italy?
Well, the Italian position, I think it's intriguing. I think Italy's lucky to have Greece in the system in a way because it's deflected all the attention. The Greek case is more serious, it's more extreme. The management of the public finance is terrible. In some ways, almost primitive. It's like third world, really, the way that Greece has run its public finances. But the fundamentals in Italy are not that much better, actually. And the debt ratio, above 130%, nearly 140% of GDP, whereas Greece is pushing 180, but not that far behind. And the key thing about Italy is that it's had next to no growth since the euro began, virtually none. When some countries had a boom, Spain and Ireland, you know, got into trouble, but they had boom years. Italy didn't have a boom year. And that's because the economy is essentially sclerotic, I think. It massively needs reform. So I would be worried about Italy, actually. It's not an immediate candidate for departure.
It does at least have a good manufacturing base in the north, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if Italy came out of the euro and the new currency, the new lira or whatever, fell 30 or 40%, I think you wouldn't see Italian industry for dust. It would be shooting away. Exports would soar, economy would take off. Why aren't they doing it?
Have you told them this?
Yes.
Hopefully they'll read the book.
Well, hopefully they'll read the book. But this is the sense in which a Greek departure, I think, is really, really important. And the people, most people taking part in this debate, still, I think, haven't got this quite right. They think the issue is about contagion from the Greek exit in terms of loss of confidence in the markets and all that sort of stuff. I think that's completely wrong. I mean, Greece is now so far on an extreme. If Greece were to leave, I don't think there'd be any contagion in the markets, really. Now, the real issue is whether the Greeks can make a success of it. And if the sign, I think it'll take about a year to tell, but if after 6 or 9 months it looks as though Greece is making a success of it, that's the real danger to the Eurozone. And at that point, the politics in Italy, Spain and Portugal get to be really interesting, because then the people turn around and say, you know what, I mean, you've been telling us to take Mrs. Merkel's medicine, and if we don't, we'll end up like Greece. Well, looking over there, I think we actually would rather like to end up like Greece. Look, they're growing, you know, growing strongly. There's several countries have experienced this. Argentina, beginning of the noughties, Iceland. I mean, no country was in a worse mess than Iceland. She zoomed back. Strong export, strong GDP performance, largely helped by a competitive exchange rate.
Mm. Can I ask you about the politics of the EU? You know, there is a view that the financial crisis has been one of the causes of the rise of nationalist politics across the EU, including, of course, in Scotland, and that one of the things that has driven that is the idea among local populations that they're being pushed around by the elites at the top, and this has driven them to pull themselves inwards back to nationalist parties.
I think there's something in that, but this is a complex issue, really. Those sorts of feelings and support for, let's say, fringe parties, non-consensus parties, does tend to rise in
weaker... I don't think we can call the SNP fringe anymore, can we?
In weaker economic times. So I think the recession, rather than the financial crisis itself, I think, has had that effect. But that's not the only reason. I think a large part of people's anxieties across Europe is now about the movement of labour. Mm-hmm. And that's only really become an issue after the admission to the EU of members of the former Eastern Bloc. And while we were stuck with pretty much the old Western European club, it wasn't a big issue. But as soon as you open up to the Polands, Hungary's, Czech Republics of this world, you then get this issue of large flows of labour. And again, of course, the concern about that tends to be strongest when unemployment is high, and that's been the position of the last few years.
Interesting. Is there a possible programme of reform that you can see that would allow the Eurozone to survive long term?
Well, the Eurozone, I suspect some countries like Greece have got to leave it. Mm-hmm. But the really big change, I think, that might save it would be the adoption by Germany of much more expansionary policies. So a more relaxed fiscal stance mm-hmm. by Germany and some of the other countries like Netherlands. And I guess a lot more QE and activism by the ECB. Okay. That might hold that together. As far as the EU is concerned, there are a whole host of things that could be done to make things a lot better. But fundamentally, to try and narrow them down to a fundamental principle, which I talk about a lot in the book, it's the principle of ever closer union. When you look at the Treaty of Rome, there's no doubt what this game was about from the beginning. It was about the construction of a political union in Europe, essentially putting the national divisions of Europe behind us all and uniting, if you like, in the United States of Europe. That's been the principle driving everything. And I don't think that's a desirable principle to adopt. I don't think it's going to work. It's a political recipe for a political nightmare, I think, in Europe. It hasn't worked economically. So the main thing, I think, to get Europe working is to draw back from that and accept that what this is an association of similar countries who are getting together for trade and friendship. And if you adopt that principle, then I think so many of these detailed reforms will simply fall into place.
Now, I think if you entered writing the book not convinced how you felt about it, you've come out the other end pretty clear, haven't you?
I have, yes, I have.
Can I ask you a little about possibly more UK economics and where we stand today? The recovery, the GDP numbers out this week have suggested that what recovery do have is slowing slightly. Where do you think we are in our cycle?
Well, for a start, these GDP figures on a quarter-by-quarter basis, you know, I mean, they're pretty loopy. The longer I go on in this subject, the more suspicious I become, I'm afraid, about national stats. And let me give you one little homespun example. Capital Economics, my company that I founded 16 years ago, still a small company, but we've got over 100 employees. We export 75% of our output around the world. I've never been asked to fill in a single form about my output or my economic activities in here, Capital Economics. I suspect in London in particular, but Britain in general, this is not unusual. The economy has gone through massive changes. We know that the small business sector has been very important. Things have been turned upside down. I wonder how many other businesses there are.
Do you know, that's very interesting. Since we launched Money Week now 15 years ago, I too have never even seen one of those forms,
right?
let alone been asked to fill one in.
That's the point.
Yeah.
So, you know, these official GDP numbers are produced by a bunch of, I'm sure they're very admirable, people, but essentially the model, the intellectual model behind the whole process, it just sounds like sort of widget counting, really.
Okay. Well, skip the numbers then. What's your feeling? Are we still in a semi-recessionary, deflationary environment?
No. I think fundamentally UK economy is in reasonable shape. And the key development is the fact that real earnings are now rising. I mean, for the last several years, the average BOD's real income has been going down.
Yeah, although I was slightly suspicious of those numbers, because if you saw the numbers that the ONS threw out a few months ago about anyone who's been in full-time employment since the beginning of the crisis has seen their real wages rise by 4%. So it depends where you look. So these average numbers are sort of slightly suspicious. And of course they don't take into account all of the redistribution.
Yeah. Don't try and blind me with science. yeah, I mean, there are different ways of looking at this. I mean, it's quite clear that what's been going on over the last several years is a squeeze on real earnings. Whether the fairest way of saying it is that people's real earnings have gone up, but not by very much, or they've fallen, that's, I think, a detailed issue. The key thing is there's been a lot of pressure on people's real earnings, and we know why, principally because of the increase in tax, the rise in oil prices since reversed, mm-hmm. and the sharp fall of the exchange rate a few years ago has meant there's been a real squeeze on people's earnings. That is now changing. And this is, I think, a very important factor. As long as energy prices stay pretty low over the next few years, I think it's right to assume that people are going to get steadily better off.
Does that mean we have to start worrying about inflation?
No. I don't think we need to worry about inflation for years still.
How many years?
I don't know that.
You've written books. You must know the answer to these questions.
No, I mean, come on. Writing that book 20 years ago, Death of Inflation, that was a pretty big call. I got that right just about. Actually, it's very amusing because I get sometimes some hate mail from readers of my Telegraph column who say to me, you wrote that book, Death of Inflation. What a load of rubbish. Last month, inflation was 0.1%. It hasn't died at all. No, I've said for a long time that I think the key issue with regard to inflation is whether and when the authorities, that's to say central banks and governments, come actually to want inflation. They're not there yet.
Don't they want inflation now with these enormous debt burdens? If you were in government, wouldn't you be hoping for 3%, 4%, 5% help you out with that a little?
Well, that's the point. You see, I mean, policy's not being operated that way at the moment. The Bank of England is essentially aiming at 2% inflation, and plenty of distinguished economists are now saying, look, the problem is you're aiming at too low a rate of inflation. Aim for 3%, 4%, or 5%. And if we get to that point, then I start to get worried about
Then you start to worry. Once you get to 5,
exactly.
It's hard to stop at 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the subject of inflation, can I move you just briefly over onto UK house prices? Mm. In the run-up to this election, we've seen pretty much every headline policy that comes out is designed to help house buyers, like to push house prices up further than they are already. And you famously for a long time were very bearish on house prices, as of course were we at Money Week. And now I know that Capital Economics certainly has changed its view and is looking for house prices this year to go, 5-6% or something. Is this about lack of supply? Is it about very low interest rates? What's your feeling on what's driving this change?
Well, first of all, both Capital Economics and Money Week were right about house prices.
Absolutely. I keep telling readers that.
This is not recognised, but we were right. Prices did fall, actually. Fell very substantially. And, of course,
terms, up in the north, they fell by 40%.
Absolutely.
Places.
So that forecast was right. Timing wasn't wonderful, but the forecast was right. This is a very difficult issue, and can I confess to feeling rather depressed about this?
Absolutely.
I'm not depressed about the forecast. I'm depressed about the politicians, because it's so obvious that this is a problem about lack of supply on the one hand, meeting artificially boosted demand on the other. And if you want people to find it easier to get the right sort of accommodation, you've just got to build the stuff, and this is all about the restrictions on the supply. But what the politicians do, of course, all the time they're doing it, is fiddling with it and making the problem worse by shoving a bit of money here and a bit of money there and a bit of restriction here and a bit of restriction there, not helping the problem at all. Now, at some stage or other, I think there's got to be a change, and the really interesting thing about the UK, interesting in the Chinese sense, that is when interest rates go up, I think there's going to be some serious, serious problems in the housing market, because there are lots of people struggling to meet their payments even now with very low rates. Now, I'm not forecasting interest rates going up soon, but at some point or other they are going to go up.
I'm going to have to ask you for a definition of soon.
Well, I think they'll start to go up probably next year, but not by very much.
Then, of course, they don't have to go up by very much to double, do they?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. But once we start getting bank rate, base rate, call it what you will, at 2 or 3%, which of course is very low by historical standards, I think there's going to be mayhem in the mortgage market. And if ever we get back to 5 or 6%, which I think we will, then it doesn't look good. Now, what I would say, I do say to people who ask me this, and I say it to my children, because housing's been a fantastic investment in the last 25 years, don't assume that it's going to be that over the next 20 years or 10 years. You know, we've all got to live somewhere, and of course living in your own home is far nicer in all sorts of ways than living in somebody owned by someone else. But do it for those reasons. Don't do it because you think you're going to make a lot of money, because I think housing is a pretty lousy investment starting from where we are now.
I take it you're not investing your pension in a buy-to-let portfolio.
I'm certainly not, no. Economists don't have much by way of pensions anyway.
Where would you invest your money now?
Well, I've got a most peculiar portfolio, really. It's very odd.
Tell us about it.
It's odd simply because I own still a very substantial part of this company, Capital Economics, which is also an equity investment. And that's always made me, with regard to the bit of my money I manage myself, as it were, pretty cautious and risk averse. So historically I've tended to own a lot of bonds, and I've government bonds, and I've still got a substantial dollop in short government bonds because I want these things to be absolutely and completely safe. Having said that, for my discretionary investment, I've been piling money into large cap equities,
which are really expensive.
Depends on what you buy, but I think the historical records I look at suggest they're not that expensive, actually. I think they're offering a reasonable return. Not that I think they're going to be a bonanza.
What sort of equities? I'm squeezing an example out for you here.
I'm loath to give away the state secrets
just
of my own portfolio.
One state
but
secret.
I own all the a few of all the usual names. I've owned some Tesco, unfortunately.
The sort of Nestle, that kind of thing.
BG, the big pharmaceutical stocks, and actually because of my long-term views about the pound, for British stocks I've tended to go for some that have a heavy export content, because I think they're going to do a lot
better.
Not
so keen on the pound, then?
I'm not keen on the pound, no, I think it's much too high.
On what basis?
on its trade-weighted index basis, on its average value, it just looks extremely high. And of course, Britain's trading performance is pretty, international trading performance is pretty poor, suggesting that the currency is too high. But in answer to your question about, you know, what would I invest in, I wanted to give a warning in that I wasn't suggesting that my portfolio was the best sort of portfolio for other people.
Absolutely not.
Because my own position is very individual.
Of course. But in a nutshell, own lots of a company that you founded, don't have any houses, and large cap equities in the UK that are export orientated.
That's about right, yeah.
Thank you very much.